Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy is a woman of uncommon intelligence, also a quite extensive background in the business of intelligence. She is, of course, Claire Lopez, the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. She is a woman of many parts, in addition to having served as a clandestine officer in the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years. She has emerged as one of the really go-to resources on a whole host of issues involving national security, most especially questions like the Iranian threat and what to do about it, and so much more in that region of the world and beyond. It's always a delight to have her with us. Claire, thanks so much for joining me. Great to have you back.
Thank you, Frank. Always glad to be with you.
Well, before we turn to the Middle East, I did want to get sort of your take on what has happened in Las Vegas in the past couple of days, and what, if anything, there may be behind this shooting. I understand that both the Islamic State and Antifa, or people who purport to be associated with these outfits, are claiming credit. Seems unlikely it's both, but might it be either? What do we know, and what does your gut instinct tell you?
Well, it's a really confusing case so far, Frank, and here we are barely a couple of days after the shooting occurred, so much of the investigation is still ongoing, of course. But we have this 64-year-old shooter named Stephen Paddock, who is a retired resident of Mesquite, Nevada, which to gamble. He was a high-stakes gambler, a retiree, apparently did quite well at it, had a $400,000 home, made a lot of money at gambling, apparently. Family members, including a brother who's spoken to the media, say there's no indication that they ever had that he had any inclination to such a murderous act as the killing. Now we have 59 dead and well over 500 more injured. I mean, as you say, yes, both online and social media, Antifa has claimed Stephen Paddock as one of their own, but so has the Islamic State through a news release on its Amaq news agency outlet claimed responsibility. And the Islamic State is not known to claim attacks with which it has had nothing to do.
There is, of course, as we've documented in some of the terrific monographs that you have helped edit at the Center for Security Policy Press, a red-green axis. And it, I guess, might be that this individual could be both, but we don't know much. Let me turn to another topic that I know you are also seized with, Claire, and that is Turkey. A country that has, for many, many years, basically since just after World War II, been considered an important ally, a very strategic nation, but that has become in recent years increasingly, well, unreliable, if not downright hostile to us as a result of the trajectory that Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey has taken it, very much in the direction of a Sharia supremacist Islamic Republic. Talk about Turkey both in its own region and what it's up to here, Claire.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank, that over the last decade and more, now President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his AK party in Turkey have turned Turkey completely away from the 20th century modernization, secularization agenda of Kemal Atatürk of the early 20th century and much more towards a neo-Ottoman jihad state. In other words, a return of Turkey to its former status, if you will, as a jihad state, seeking for power and influence in the region, clearly, in the Middle East. More troubling for us here in the United States is the role that Turkey seems to be playing here. And that directly with the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood. It would seem in a way that within the OIC, that's the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, that perhaps in some sense as I've been putting it, the baton has been passed in terms of leadership, Dawa leadership in any case, been passed from Saudi Arabia to Turkey. And so here in the U.S., we've seen the new Islamic Center, a Turkish Islamic Center belonging to the government agency, the Diyanet, in Lanham, Maryland, attended by President Erdogan and then President Obama, but also the construction of many Turkish mosques belonging to a network attached to that facility in Lanham, Maryland. And then, as I said, a very close relationship with the top leadership of the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, and Claire, I think particularly of concern is that we're looking at, as you say, a burgeoning sort of infrastructure being sponsored by the Turks. Talk a little bit about the piece of this that is seemingly at odds with the Erdogan regime, but I'm afraid has a lot to do with at least its agenda in this country, namely the Gulen movement's academic institutions, charter schools, now hundreds of them, I believe, across the United States.
Yes, indeed. Well, Fethullah Gulen, of course, is a Sunni Turkish cleric, has been living in exile in the United States in a guarded compound in the Poconos Mountains in Pennsylvania since 1999, ideologically a pea in a pod with President Erdogan in Turkey, formerly allies, as a matter of fact, for many, many years in Turkey. And that is to say they are both followers of the doctrine of the Muslim Brotherhood. They are jihadists. Here in the United States, though, as you say, Frank, it's very concerning that Gulen has established a large network of charter schools, typically STEM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, and math curriculum, often in underserved areas, which parents love to get a new choice of a good school, but also a network of cultural centers, Turkish cultural centers. And the problem with these is not that there's an Islamic curriculum being taught in the schools. There's not, to the best of our knowledge, but rather that there's an emphasis on a promotion of Turkish culture and history and language in a way as a sort of a gateway to Islam in that way.
This is the subject of a terrific book that you co-authored, The Gulen Movement, Turkey's Islamic Supremacist Cult and Its Contributions to the Civilization Jihad. Claire, speaking of Turkey, one of its most neuralgic points is the extent to which the Kurds are seeking to separate themselves from Turkey. There are a lot of them in particularly southeastern Turkey. We've been discussing elsewhere in the program, my commentary, this referendum that Kurds in northern Iraq have recently overwhelmingly approved for independence. Talk a little bit about this referendum, if you would, and what it might mean for the Turks and perhaps others in the region.
Well, the Kurds are one of the largest nations of people on the face of the earth that have never had an actual nation state of their own. Instead, beginning in the 20th century or even before, perhaps, the great powers, meaning Britain, France, and eventually, yes, the United States too, sought to keep Kurdish people separated and divided up into different countries. So there are large Kurdish populations in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And it is those in northern of what used to be called Iraq that formed the Kurdish Regional Government, or KRG, back in the time of Saddam Hussein, when the U.S. and the Western powers helped to protect them against Saddam Hussein. Well, that entity, the KRG, is what just now, a few days ago, held this referendum asking for people's opinion on whether they wanted to separate or to be independent. Overwhelmingly, those who voted said yes. The problem, of course, is that neighboring states, namely Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, all with populations of Kurds within their borders, are now concerned that there would be more separatism that would tear their nation states apart, change borders. And the United States, up until now, at least, has expressed disapproval of the Kurdish referendum, and I guess of any separatism in the vain, I think it's vain hope, that the former Iraq can somehow be patched back together again.
Claire, this is a subject to which we're going to have to return, because I know there are concerns about some of the Kurdish policies and practices, particularly on the part of some other people who live in their neighborhood, the Yazidis notably. I want to talk with you also about what might flow from this independence movement, but that is for another day. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to picking up again on this and other topics with you very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Sean Davis of TheFederalist.com. He is a go-to guy on the culture war as well as the implications for gun control of this campaign now following from the Nevada shooting. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Sean Davis, a man who I've admired for a long time. He has been giving some considerable thought to the issues we were just discussing with Claire Lopez with respect to this attack in Las Vegas. He is the co-founder of a terrific online resource, The Federalist. Formerly, he served as an economic policy advisor to Texas Governor Rick Perry, now the Secretary of Energy. He's also been the chief financial officer of the Daily Caller and a chief investigator for Senator Tom Coburn. All impressive credentials. It makes us all the more anxious to hear from him. Welcome back, Sean. It's good to talk with you.
Good to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. You have been doing some thinking, as I say, particularly in the aftermath of this most recent horror in Las Vegas, about the argument that is always trotted out that this is simply a new case for comprehensive gun control. Give us your thoughts on how that actually sorts in practice. Is that really needed? Or if it is, would it work?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a hard one to tackle today particularly because despite what we think we know or what we have been told about the shooting yesterday, there is still a ton of information we don't know. So we know they found a whole bunch of guns in his hotel rooms, which he apparently had two, found a bunch of guns at his residence. I think they found 19 there and 23 in the hotel room. We believe he used something, either he used a weapon capable of fully automatic fire, or he used some aftermarket tweaks or changes to simulate the effect of fully automatic fire. We don't know which one of those he did yet. It could have been one of either, could have been both. And that has some really serious legal implications. And so there's a lot we don't know. What we do know, and what I find most frustrating about the gun control debate in particular, is the debate that we have, whether this gun should be banned or that gun should be banned. I think it's not the actual argument that we're having. The real argument we're having is about the state of human nature, and that the real debate is between those who believe that human nature is inherently sinful and fallen, that people are unavoidably corrupt and sinful down to their core. And as a result, you can't prevent evil. You can't legislate away the intent to do evil in a man's heart. And then on the other side, you have a point of view that says, you know what, maybe human nature actually is perfectible. Maybe it can be really, really good. And all we need to perfect is human nature and get rid of all these evil, violent, sinful inclinations is to have the right laws and the right people administering them. To me, that's what the gun control debate actually comes down to. If you think that you can just legislate away evil intent in man's heart, then by all means, gun control makes perfect sense. Just get rid of the bad things, and then people won't want to do bad things with those bad things. I come down with the viewpoint that you can't prevent people from wishing to do evil, and the man intent on committing awful, heinous, violent acts will find a way to do it regardless of what tools are available to him.
There's a lot of history to support that theory, I think it seems to me. And the old line, I think it was Samuel Johnson, about the triumph of hope over experience is that somehow even the best laws, even the best administrators, even the best enforcement of the laws still leaves a lot of running room for bad people to do bad things. So when you look at the laws that are on the books now, Sean Davis, do you come away convinced that to the extent you can legislate, we've got what's needed? And would it have made a difference as a practical matter, given the nature of this individual as we're coming to know him? Or for that matter, others who have found ways to get their hands on various weapons, whether it's guns or you know, trucks or bombs or what have you, that we're really, you know, legislated sufficiently for this purpose, at least.
Right. So I don't think our federal gun law regime in America is perfect by any stretch of the imagination. There's all kinds of tweaks you can make to make it better. But the fact of the matter is that most of the solutions, in fact, like all of the solutions that people are spending their time talking about, wouldn't have had an impact whatsoever on what happened here. And in fact, when it comes to machine guns, fully automatic guns, assault rifles, those are all roughly the same thing. Those have been heavily, heavily regulated by the federal government going back to 1934. If you want to go and waltz into a gun dealer today and walk out with a machine gun, you're not going to walk out with it, because the process of legally getting a machine gun is so extensive, it's so burdensome, it's costly, it will take likely more than a year. If you want to get a legal machine gun, it's going to cost you about $20,000. And if you want to make a new one or buy a new one that was manufactured post 1986, it's legally impossible. Those have been banned since May 19th, 1986. So when it comes to fully automatic weapons, I don't know what we can do that we've not done that the gun controllers are demanding. They have to be registered. They have to be licensed. You have to pay a tax on them. You have to get a lengthy, lengthy background check involving fingerprints and photographs. It takes up to a year. That's the regime we have on the books, and that didn't stop what happened in Las Vegas.
Let me switch gears with you, if I can, Sean Davis. Piece prominently featured on the Federalist.com website today caught my eye. Its headline is, Donald Trump isn't fighting a culture war, but a cultural revolution. It's by Elizabeth Cantor. You give a lot of thought to these sorts of issues at the Federalist, and I'm interested in your take on what Donald Trump is confronting. It certainly seems as though he's under endless political assault. The press and others, notable exception being the Federalist, I think, are relentlessly hounding him. But it does seem as though it's kind of a much bigger assault on our country that's at work here. A cultural revolution may be as good a way to describe it as any. Would you share with us your thoughts on that?
It is, and I think to really understand the depth and breadth of the problem, you have to look at what's happening on college campuses. We are a nation that was founded on the ideal that we all are given certain rights by our creator that nobody can take away, and that the point of government is to secure those rights. And in order to do so, we have a constitution that affirms and gives the government the ability to protect those rights on our behalf. And yet what we're seeing on college campuses, which is just ground zero for this revolution, is a massive, massive attack on First Amendment freedoms, whether it's speech or press or exercise of religion. We're seeing attacks on due process when it comes to the right of somebody who's been accused of a crime to defend himself, to face his or her accuser, to have counsel present, to have a jury of his peers adjudicate his guilt or innocence. All of those are under attack, and it's all filtering up and flowing out of the college campus to the point now where we actually have a discussion about whether religious people are allowed to practice their religion in the public sphere, about whether people are allowed to say things that are offensive to someone somewhere out there. It is a radical, radical alteration of what we have assumed were our rights in this country for over 200 years. It's terrifying.
Well, not only assumed they were our rights, they are constitutionally guaranteed as having been provided to us by our creator, as you know, Sean Davis. And so when people start saying, well, oh, not actually, and start stripping them away, as I'm fully convinced is happening now with, as you said initially there, our freedom of speech, this is a very serious threat to the republic. It's not just a cultural revolution. I think it really is a formula for undoing this constitutional republic. We appreciate tremendously the work you and your colleagues at thefederalist.com do to stand up for that constitution and for our freedoms and for the country as well. Keep it up, my friend. I hope you'll come back to us very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Bruce Klingner about the latest developments in North Korea and the risk of miscalculation or worse. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, switching gears now, to North Korea, a problem that is often in the news, even if at the moment it's obscured by some preoccupations here at home. Following it throughout is Bruce Klingner, one of our go-to guys on the Hermit Kingdom and more generally the Korean Peninsula. He is the Senior Research Fellow on Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center for Security Policy. He is also a contributor to Heritage's Daily Signal. Prior to all of this, he has had a very distinguished career in the intelligence community, working in this space, including as the chief of the CIA's Korea branch and also as the deputy division chief for Korea for the Central Intelligence Agency. It's great to have you back, Bruce. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me back.
There is a report that you have been asked to come talk to the North Koreans about all of this, but talk to us, if you would, about, first of all, how you would characterize the state of affairs at the moment. Are we in an extremely dangerous situation? Are we in a situation that is headed that way or something else?
Well, we really always are in a very bad situation with North Korea. You know, as people on the peninsula will tell you, we're always on the knife edge of a crisis, and that there's always the danger that a tactical situation can become strategic in the blink of an eye. And yet, on the other hand, we've sort of muddled along or muddled through without a major conflagration, you know, even though such has been predicted for years. So I think really, though, more tense in the last 6 months or so, and a number of reasons for that. One is North Korea's growing nuclear and missile capability. They've made a number of breakthroughs in the last 6 months or last year. And I found over the years a tendency by many to downplay or dismiss North Korea's ability to achieve certain objectives, and then people are surprised when they do exactly that. So we've seen breakthroughs in a submarine-launched ballistic missile, which exposes South Korea's flanks to a nuclear attack, two different intermediate-range missiles, which could reach Guam, a key base for the U.S. defense of the Pacific, including Korea, and then, of course, the ICBM, which has gotten the most attention in the U.S. because they've had two successful tests indicating that it does have a range of hitting at least a large portion of the continental U.S., and then finally, an H-bomb test, you know, much, much larger than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki-type bombs that they've exploded in the past.
So the threat is clearly intensifying. The rhetoric has been as well. You've been critical of some of the back and forth between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. In its stead, we've had the Secretary of State off to China, working apparently back channels with the North Koreans. The president has signaled his displeasure with that, or at least has suggested that's a waste of time. What do you make of it, Bruce Klingner?
It's a bit confusing. I think this past week we've seen conflicting signals. Whether it's part of a strategy or not is a bit unclear. We had H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, saying we don't have any contact with North Korea, followed, I believe, by a day later, Tillerson saying we have three different channels of dialogue, but unspecified what those were. And then the president coming back to say, don't waste your time, Rex. We'll do what needs to be done, which whether that meant pressure, and I think the administration has been increasing pressure on North Korea lately, or whether it sort of resurrects the suggestion that the U.S. is considering a preventative attack, a military strike, even if we don't feel we are in imminent danger. But, you know, a bit of conflicting signals. Some would say it's, as I said, sort of a good cop, bad cop, to, you know, designed to induce pressure on North Korea as well as China. Or is it a bit of conflicting signals? And I think it fits the trend we've had since inauguration of very divergent signals coming from the administration, which certainly is confused and concerned our allies. And, you know, if those of us in Washington who follow this every day are confused, you can only imagine you know, people overseas trying to discern a pattern from a distance.
Well, let me ask you, you have been closely following developments across the portfolio, not just in the military sphere, I know. When you look at what's going on at the moment, the intensifying economic sanctions, particularly those that are now finally, I think, it seems to me helpfully, squeezing the communist Chinese, as well as the rhetoric, as well as the back-channel negotiations or at least conversations. And to some extent, it seems some ramping up of the military planning, at least, by General Mattis and his team. Do you think that the right sorts of steps are being taken, with the possible exception of this rhetorical exchange, Brisklinger, or is there something else that we should be doing that we're not? And if there is something, should it be in the diplomatic arena, given some pretty hard experience with the North Koreans? Notably, I'm thinking of the deals struck by the Clinton and Bush administrations with these guys, only to find that there was no there there.
Right. I think really the components are there, but it's just they may not be being applied as effectively as they could. I've long been an advocate for more fully enforcing U.S. law and U.N. resolutions, and so that the sanctions or targeted financial measures, they have a number of objectives. It's to enforce our laws and U.N. resolutions. It's to impose a penalty on those that violate them. You know, if they're to mean anything, you have to defend them by enforcing them. It also puts in place measures to make it harder for North Korea to import and export things that they need for their prohibited programs. And then finally, you're hoping with all the other instruments of national power to change North Korea's calculus and, get them to abide by all this. So, I think the pressure, we're finally gaining momentum on that. And I think a lot of it has been pressure from Congress to try to get the executive branch to use the authorities it already has. I welcome the recent executive order by the Trump administration. But the question would be, as with all the other laws that the Treasury Department and other departments didn't fully enforce, will it be enforced? Will Treasury be more likely to impose measures against what's even legitimate legal trade with North Korea than they have been in pursuing those that were violating U.S. law? So I think also the announcements by China that their banks and businesses will stop doing business with North Korea, that's very encouraging. It's potentially significant, but it needs enforcement to move it from potential to significant.
As ever, that's the rub. Lastly, Brisklinger, do you think there is any actual prospect that we will avoid potentially disastrous conflict here, short of a change in the regime in North Korea? And is it your judgment that that's something that is becoming increasingly seen as necessary by the Chinese as well?
We've always worried about sort of stumbling into a conflict. And so, if we're aware of it, we can try to take steps to avoid it, but while still enforcing laws and resolutions. So, I'm not worried that crazy Kim Jong-un is going to wake up some morning in a lunatic state, launch a war. He's not crazy. He's a brutal, terrible dictator. But neither he nor his father were crazy in that they would just launch a war. I'm more concerned, as I have been for a long time, of either escalation or miscalculation. Escalation, where you have a tactical level clash, which just sort of tit for tat escalates up to a larger conflict, or miscalculation. And the thing is, as North Korea develops and demonstrates and brags about its nuclear capability, it may lead the U.S. to feel it has to lean further forward during a crisis if we detect some signs of military movement that we think might be nuclear related. And also South Korea has pointed out to North Korea that they have their own ability to decapitate leadership, as they've said, and they would launch it on signs that North Korea is about to do something. And it's based on intelligence, which is, sometimes faulty. And North Korea said, well, we'll preempt your preemption. If we think you are about to preempt us, we will do so to you. So you have three militaries, close proximity, things can happen. And you also have, with whether it's the rising rhetoric or the rising North Korean capabilities, the greater potential, I think, that you could either have to feel you need to do a preemptive attack or sort of stumble into that situation.
Well, grist for the mill, and obviously a full employment program for you, Bruce Klingner at the Heritage Foundation. We appreciate your work there, and you're joining us from time to time to discuss it with us. I hope you'll come back to us very soon, and that in the meantime, cool heads will prevail in this very difficult and dangerous environment. Folks, next up, we'll talk with Kevin Freeman about another potential issue with China, a conspiracy against the dollar. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Time for our regular visit with Kevin Freeman, who takes us inside the Economic War Room, the title of his forthcoming television program. He is, of course, the best-selling author of Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is, among other things, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, specializing in his prime portfolio of economic warfare for us. He is also, very pleased to say, a fabulous online resource at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin Freeman, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Let's talk about some writing that you have been doing, I think, since we last talked. I know it's a subject we've touched on repeatedly, and I'd like to get you back on for a full hour to do a proper drill down on this, Kevin, because the stakes are incalculably high. And you point out in a post on the 26th, I think, of last month, that the vast majority of us are unaware that the dollar has been losing value. And you suggest that there are a lot of reasons for that, but there is also what you say can only be termed as an active conspiracy to displace the dollar that may be contributing to that weakness and more as well. Tell us a little bit about what the symptoms of that conspiracy are.
Well, there's no doubt that there is a conspiracy to displace the dollar. Whether it'll be effective or not is a completely different question. But Russia, elements in China, Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, and others, and in the Middle East even, that are supposed allies, oil-producing nations, they've all decided that the dollar cannot continue forever in its reign as the global reserve currency. And so what we've seen, an active liquidation, for example, of dollars being held by Saudi Arabia and others. Now, granted, there's a very benign explanation. Oil prices are down. They're hurting for cash. They have to liquidate their treasuries. But it's symptomatic of a larger issue. The Chinese have also been known to go through serious bouts of dollar liquidation and selling of treasuries. So we see a number of effects happening around the world, and we just assume that everything's perfectly normal, but it's not. Things are changing.
And you make a pretty compelling case that the steps that these countries are taking to try to put into place what I kind of think of as the economic infrastructure that's required to support an alternative to the dollar of one kind or another are now far advanced. One that you say is tricky, but that is also coming into place, is sort of an alternative credible debt market that would attract foreign capital is coming into place. So, Kevin, how quickly could people in China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, elsewhere, the BRIC countries as they're called, pull this off, do you think? Is this imminent?
Well, one of the things that you have to be a reserve currency is you have to have the ability to take on large amounts of reserves. We have a $20 trillion federal debt, and that's a very deep and liquid debt market. And the argument's been made that no one could ever rival it. But that's simply not the case. The Chinese debt markets, they're actually rapidly building up their debt, which looks like a serious problem for their economy and probably is. But if they can transition to the where the world sees them as the economic leader and not the United States, they'll have foreign funding of that debt. They'll go from a basically strong creditor nation to a debtor nation, and they'll have essentially displaced our position. So it can happen. It's happening now. Maybe in the next 5 years, they may have a debt market market as deep as ours.
With very profound implications for our debt, our budget, our economy, our security as well. Kevin, you've also called to my attention something else that's going on that has implications both for all of that for North Korea. Talk a little bit about what the North Koreans are seemingly up to with respect to Bitcoin. Some people think it may be an alternative currency for the dollar, too. Where are we on that story?
Well, North Korea has a long history of counterfeiting U.S. dollars as a means of obtaining hard currency. They've been the world's most prolific counterfeiter of $100 bills.
Apparently very high quality at that.
Oh, yes, extraordinary quality and almost impossible to distinguish. And that's why we changed our $100 bill multiple times in the past couple of decades. But they're now in the business of stealing Bitcoin, hacking into Bitcoin repositories, and mining Bitcoin, which is a legitimate legal means of obtaining Bitcoin. What they're saying is this is possibly a way to get around global monetary sanctions. It's a possibly a way for them to get the ability to buy and sell goods and services. Now, some people like Jamie Dimon will look at Bitcoin and say it's a big Ponzi scheme, but we always must remember that money is only money because we say it is. And if the world agreed that seashells were money, they would be money. If the world agrees Bitcoin is money, and Christine Lagarde recently from the IMF has suggested that every problem of Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies in general, not just specifically the one Bitcoin, but every problem can be solved, and at some point that may be the world's currency. North Korea is getting ahead of this. At the same time, South Korea is banning the use of Bitcoin. The Japanese are licensing the use of Bitcoin, and the Chinese, I think, are very confused as to exactly how they want to handle it. But this is a very leading edge technological means of possibly displacing the dollar at some point in the future, and North Korea is jumping on that bandwagon.
And you'd think, Kevin Freeman, you're a student of finance as well as economic warfare, that it would kind of be a showstopper for Bitcoin if people can hack into it, isn't it? I mean, doesn't that fundamentally mean that you've got the ability to counterfeit there too, which corrupts the whole system, I would think?
Well, but those technological problems can be addressed and they can be fixed. You can hack into the Federal Reserve. It's been done. You can hack into the SWIFT transaction system. So those who dismiss Bitcoin entirely do so at their own peril. I don't know where it will land, but ultimately the technology, the blockchain technology that's behind Bitcoin, will have something to do with the global monetary system. And a mutual friend of ours, Patrick Byrne, firmly believes this, and he's actually put his company Overstock.com in the position to not only accept Bitcoin, but to issue security in the form of Bitcoin security so that you could buy stock in Overstock and it would be kept in the blockchain as opposed to in the normal stock transaction system.
Fascinating. Kevin Freeman, very quickly, one of the things we've been talking about earlier in the program with Bruce Klingner is the pressure by the Trump administration on North Korea, specifically using financial sanctions on Chinese banks that do business with it. Are we seeing signs that that is having an effect on the North Koreans, do you think? And what effect is it having on the Chinese?
Well, there's no doubt it's having an effect. North Korea's economy does not exist without China. But the North Koreans are very resourceful, and they're moving around this, Bitcoin being one form of it. They're actually moving to create alternative internet service provision with Russia as an alternative to the Chinese internet service provision that they've been using. So they're showing a willingness to adapt around it. But yes, pressuring China and the Chinese banks will have an enormous impact on North Korea, and the Chinese will have to decide what side they want to be on. If they have been playing both sides, and so far effectively, hopefully we can shut that down.
Indeed. A lot's riding on it, needless to say. Kevin Freeman, a lot is riding on your insights into economic warfare, both that that's being waged against us and instruments we could use to advance our security interests in this domain. I know it will be a feature of your new program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We can't wait for its debut. Thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.